broadcasters without coming from some spiritual base. That doesn't fit the Christian Buddhist to be individual. So I think the first 300 years the church had an effort for a faith.
I know it, and he was someone, and he is specialized in historical manual of the migrants, and we thought about that.
can't hear you.
Hello, sorry.
Yeah. There's Ozan.
Hello.
Why am I? Yeah.
Open up my camera as well.
Sorry. Hi, Ozan. Can you hear me?
Yeah, loud and clear. Just not sure of my camera, though.
Hi, Eski. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Annie.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. Hi, Annie. Hi. How are you all?
Just going to reconnect real quick to see if the camera will work.
Right, we're just getting speaker working here now. We're in business almost.
I'm not familiar with this now.
Okay, can one of you say hello to us again so we can see if we can hear you?
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, yeah, we're nearly. Hi, Lucky, how are
Maybe
you?
Maybe start with Lucky while I do the technical things.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask Karen to set up.
Yeah. There's Connor, there's a Bluetooth speaker in my computer bag, which is behind Kevin Doyle's stall in the corner, if you need it.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, sorry, guys. We're just having a little technical hitch here with the sound. So can you all hear us? Okay.
Clear.
That's great. But that's a good starting point. So Lucky here has joined us. Lucky is from the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland. And we have a full room of people patiently sitting, waiting while I grappled with the technical end of stuff. I'm Greg. I'm going to just coordinate this meeting. So if it's okay with our three speakers, we have Ozan from the Legal Centre Lesvos. We have Annie from Border Violence Monitoring Network. And we've Ezgi, I hope I'm saying your name right, who's an activist from Turkey working in northern Syria. And the topic of the meeting is organizing against Fortress Europe. So if it's okay with you three guys, I might start with Lucky while we sort out the technical difficulties here in terms of the speaker, although it might've just been done by pressing the button. maybe would one of you say hello to us again? See, can we hear you this time?
Hello.
Yeah, that was so easy. Thank you. Okay, so, well, it's up to yourselves which way you'd like to run this, whether Lucky, do you want to go first, or do you want will we get the three speakers from that are online to go first and then come to you? Yeah. Okay, so it's a general discussion around, all of you are involved in work around the borders of Europe and supporting migrant entry into Europe, etc. So a little bit about yourselves, your work and the political issues that's raised, and I suppose the difficulty of organizing in such a difficult environment as well. So who would like to go first? Ezgi?
I mean, really,
Ozan, yeah.
Really up to you guys. We had a chat before, all of
okay,
you.
Okay, sorry, yeah.
To be honest with you, I would be personally very happy to hear Lucky first, if you're not going to, you know, do a combo breaker, to also have a bit of an idea about what you guys are doing. Sorry, I couldn't work my camera out for some reason, but I'll be more than happy to listen to Lucky first, if that's okay with you guys.
That's okay, you'd like to hear Lucky first. Yeah, no problem. He was hoping he'd hear you first, but that doesn't matter. He's okay with that too. So I'll just introduce Lucky. He's representative of the Movement of Asylum Seekers in Ireland, which is an independent platform for asylum seekers organizing together here to seek justice, freedom and dignity for asylum seekers in Ireland. And they've been under a lot of pressure and a lot of work on their plate, especially over the last number of weeks and months. So I'll just hand over to Lucky to talk to us for 10 to 15 minutes or so about Massey and the work that you guys get up to.
Okay. Am I okay? Yeah.
Can you hear him from there? Or maybe he's... Can you hear him?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just trying to coordinate with Liam at the same time. That's why. Sorry, guys.
Oh, yeah. Cool. No problem. Yeah, where you go, Lucky. And just to let everybody know, the meeting has been recorded as well. Just for, we'll put it out on social media afterwards. Yep.
Projector.
Go for it.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. And good afternoon to our online audience there and panel individuals. As I said, my name is Lucky Kambole. I originally come from South Africa. It's been 10 years now since I've been here in this country. And I lived in this system called direct provision when I came here as an international protection applicant. I found the system to be toxic at that time, where we did not have any right at all, no right to work, no right to study, no right to drive, no right to open an account, actually no right to live as a human being in direct provision. So we started organizing ourselves as people that seek protection to articulate the issues that we are facing and to raise awareness to the rest of the people about the plight of the people that were housed in these hostels for many, many years with only an allowance at that time of £19 and €19.10 that we were expected to leave. The child was about €9 that they were getting at that time. So this is the ninth year now Mercy exists. Our first kind of action, direct action that led to the formation of Mercy was to resist the brutal treatment of asylum seekers who were living in Cork Kinsale accommodation, where I was at that time, where we staged a lockout protest that lasted about 10 days, where we managed as residents to lock out the staff, to not have access to the center while we were negotiating our own kind of ways with the government department that was responsible at that time. So then from there onwards, having achieved what we wanted to achieve on issues that we were facing there, and then we moved to mobilize nationally with the rest of the centers. Hard as it was, because as you would know that these centers are placed in many areas, in isolated areas. So we had to reach out to these centers and started to conscientize people with regard to their rights, with regard to the importance of us getting together, and also to try and take away the fear that people had that if you start speaking up as a person that seeks protection, you seem to be breaking the law, you can be deported or your case can be withdrawn. So there was that kind of fear that was always instilled when we got into these centers. So ours was to make sure that people do, so that they can be able to get on board, to understand that if you do this the right way, you are not gonna be affected by it. Your case will still go on. And a lot of us were proof of that, because even after that kind of action that we did, it was the first of its kind in this island, we still got our residency, which was in 2014 when we did the protest, and I got my residency in 2016, in spite of what I was kind of being vocal, talking to media and stuff like that. So, and that is one of the most difficult part of us organizing in Mercy, in terms of the masses, trying to make them understand that it is a right to seek protection, and you don't need to be grateful in order to succumb to the pressures that you find from the people that are actually supposed to be giving service to you. And they there's this thing that they say, you are fortunate to be here. You don't get this where you come from. You should just be grateful and keep quiet. That is what is still going on at this stage. So there's a lot of stuff that we have done. Then we lobby with the government to try and do these changes. And one of the significant changes that happened through our activism and advocacy was in 2017, a case that went to High Court or to Supreme Court, actually, and where seven judges ruled that the total ban of asylum seekers not to work in Ireland was unconstitutional, and the government were forced to come with a legislation that we've seen to do that. So in 2018, then there was the right to work. It came with restrictions, but we continuously advocated for these restrictions to be lifted. But I'm glad to say now, a person that comes in the country, after 6 months, they can engage into a labor market, and that permit goes on for 12 months, which is renewable. But there are stumbling blocks that are still there in terms of people accessing this labor market, which was continuously talking about them, whereby if you get your negative response, for instance, within 6 months of being in the country, and it becomes negative, which means you then don't qualify for that right to work anyway for the rest of your application. So if you get that negative response within that period. So that is another kind of a stumbling block in progress. And because a lot of people now who get called as quickly as possible do get that rejection within that 6 months, then that means that they don't qualify for that. The minister as well, last November, on the 7th or the 8th of November, they made the changes into the asylum process, whereby they deemed some of the countries safe countries, and then they changed the system in terms of how to take the applications from them. So they are forcing people to submit the applications right there at the Office of International Protection without having legal assistance, without having any guidance in terms of the completion of that form. So there is no legal intervention at that time. So it leaves a lot of people in danger of making errors, which will live with them for the duration of their time, because the solicitors are not able to intervene before a person goes to the interview, thus increasing the chances of people getting deported. And that is the aim of the government, to start to do that process anyway. So, but it's something that it's a new thing, and we are trying to get the solicitors as well to be at the forefront and to back us up in terms of changing that legislation to make sure that people are given a fair chance to present their case of asylum to the government. I'll stop here, and if there's any other questions, then I can elaborate more on other stuff that we do. And I mean, before I stop, let me just mention this, which is something that is really, really bugging us for the past, I would say, 6 months. All right, the rise of the far right. It is something that is scary. It's scary what the far right has been allowed to do in terms of the people that seek protection here, the people that are already vulnerable, the people that are already traumatized, going to their centers and shout, "Go home, Ireland is full." Going to the tents where people are going, that are sleeping in the tents there, of which from here, I'm gonna go there to feed them outside that IPO. You get the far right stopping buses that are going to people, to places where people are finding houses, and to start doing the head counts, disrespecting people, dehumanizing people when you are not authorized to do so. And that is normalized by the officials. It's normalized by the people that are supposed to condemn such in a strongest possible way. We can't always be saying this is wrong, this is wrong. We need, especially the elected officials, to come on board to say this is not right. People that break the law in terms of what they are doing need to be inside the bus. need to be locked out and take responsibility of their actions. So that is a hindrance in us trying to get people out and come to the rallies, for instance, where the rally, beautiful, powerful rally on the 18th of March. It's a scary moment for people to be even going out to be seen in the rallies. We were there, but people are scared. It's very hard to organize in that way. So I just wanted to end with that one.
Thanks, Lucky. And maybe that might be something we'll come back to in the conversation, because I think probably where we're all at the moment is a bit of a feeling of helplessness, perhaps to some extent, in terms of how we deal with that, what we see as really, really scary stuff at the moment from the far right. So it might be where we come back to a conversation. Maybe people want to bring the conversation in a different direction. But can I just ask, just in terms of the audience, everyone okay, comfortable just taking a photograph? Yeah, nobody has a problem with that. Okay, just because I think this is the fact that there's such a huge turnout at this meeting is really powerful. And for those of you that are on screen, the room is jammed. So for 50 people here in the room, it's fantastic. Who'd like to come next? Will I just volunteer one of you, Dan? is that you volunteering? Yes.
No, yeah, we kind of went out to that level that maybe, you know, starting with Lesbos, which is a bit more related with the other people, was the decision. But I just want to check with Annie and Ezgi if that's okay, if you want to change it or not. Okay. Sorry, Gregor, I'm having a bit of a trouble with my camera for some reason, although that it's open, it's not showing. I hope I will be able to share my screen. That's my concern now, but let's see.
Okay. Yes. Okay, yes.
Is it visible?
Yes.
Nice. Let's also do one more try if I can change the... Yes, I think I can, huh? I can change
perfect.
The...
Yes, you can, yes.
All right. Sorry, everybody. I would be more than happy to show my face and also maybe see your faces as well, but maybe that's for the end of it. Thanks, Lucky, also for this... You know, it's important what you underline in terms of creating a self-organized movement based on people on the move and the trouble that it might bring in terms of fear and being on the streets. I will try to cut it really short to give some more space to Annie and Ezgi, but at the same time to maybe have like an actual engagement on Q&A, just to give you a bit of an extent of what's happening in Lesbos and the potentials, the possibilities and the counterpower that somehow exists in the island. So again, for people who might not be very familiar with the routes or where Lesbos is located, I just wanted to give it a bit of a, you know, situate you a little bit. This is a bit of an old map that we designed in the past. So, but it kind of underlines the main routes towards continental or Northern Europe. You can today add this, the Belarusian and Polish border, Ukraine after the Russian invasion. So probably there are many more arrows going towards the heart of Europe these days. I wanted to point this out to draw your interest to the line between Turkey and Greece, because this is where we kind of focus a little bit. And yeah, here's where Lesbos lies. As you can see, it's much closer to anywhere in Turkey than Athens, which is the capital city. And here's what Lesbos looks like when we add up the actors that are playing an important role when it comes to quote unquote border violence or about the arrivals of people on the move, refugees, migrants, asylum seekers. Just wanted to underline one fact on the right button. You can see that, you know, civil society organizations are not allowed to operate in the sea since roughly around 5 years. And this causes some sort of like a disruption of intervention that we can conduct as you know, international society or solidarity movements. And this is unfortunately how Lesbos looks like in the absence of search and rescue or intervention. On the left, you can see a great work that Forensic Architecture conducted about pinpointing and mapping events that could be considered border violence or pushbacks that have taken place around Lesbos. This map actually extends all the sea border of Greece between Turkey. Every single dot that you've seen is a recorded event of pushback. I'm sure Annie will get into more detail on this, so I will just cut it very brief. But what we call a pushback is where migrants who have arrived to the island or on the way while they're on the sea have been intercepted by the Coast Guard, sometimes by Frontex, put into the life rafts that you can see on the right, and will be left to drift towards Turkey in the hopes that they will be picked up by the Turkish Coast Guard, therefore being denied of their ability to seek asylum in the first place legally. This is what we consider as completely against the international law, be it the sea law or international law in general, but above all, that we have carried on to the European Court of Human Rights as crimes against humanity. Again, when we come to Lesbos, we kind of understand the whole concept of solidarity and criminalization of solidarity as like two sides of the coin. On one hand, you have people on the move being criminalized due to their activities. And on the other hand, you have people who are in solidarity with migrants being criminalized due to their activities. On the left, you can see a drawing of a friend of ours for the infamous case of Moria 6. Moria 6 was one of those terrible, infamous cases that six people have been judged of burning down the previous Moria camp, which has been torn down in 2020, September, where it was hosting roughly around 20,000 people. It was burned down on September, and without any credible evidence or eyewitnesses, six people, which four of them were minors back then, have been accused of burning down the whole camp and causing damage to property and somehow risking the lives of the people. However, since the 3 years that have passed from the court, there's still no credible evidence, and there's still the eyewitnesses are only the police officers that have been working in the camp and no other. Unfortunately, last March, their last appeal court has been seen, and it has been postponed one more year. And although that we did an intervention in the Supreme Court for their release during the trial procedure, it has been also rejected within 15 minutes. So one form of criminalization of people on the move is creating this sort of hyper-legalized loop for migrants where they can end up in jail for years and years until they can get a decision related to the judgment that have been proposed to them. And on the right, you can see another infamous case, the case of Amir and Razuli, which were considered to be two boat drivers accused of smuggling people and illegal entry. To create a bit more context of what we call the boat drivers or captains, for those of you who might not be aware, EU law dictates that any boat that arrives to the soil of EU has one captain, and that captain, therefore, is the smuggler himself. However, the reality shows that since the smuggling networks, specifically in Turkey and Greece, are quite aware of this fact, they themselves almost never send anybody from their network to drive the boat. This often leads up into boats that are arrived have been sought immediately by officials, namely the police, the Coast Guard, and Frontex, to seek one or two boat drivers and immediately sentence them on the basis of smuggling charges. Unfortunately, these charges they start from 5 to 15 years immediately by being the captain, and another 5 to 25 years based on the amount of people that are on the boat. So if you have, say, four people on the boat, you can be judged to 20 to 100 years immediately. Therefore, we often witness, as an organization that provides free legal aid to migrants, of cases of boat drivers that can end up hundreds of years in jail. I will get back to Amir and Razuli and open up the boat driver issue a little bit more. But one statistical note to underline is that about 52% of the jail inmate population in Greece are also constituted from migrants. So what we are actually contemplating here is from 70,000 to 80,000 people, depending on which statistic you choose, are in jail due to smuggling charges and are actually of migrant origin in Greece right now. So when we come to the flip side of the coin, which is the criminalization of solidarity, or specifically here, the sea rescue and monitoring, I'm sure speaking of Ireland, most of you might have heard the infamous case of Sean Binder and Sarah Mardini are involved, which is still taking place. And there will be the last court also seen last Tuesday. Along with other organizations such as Sea-Watch or Aegean Boat Report, which are trying to create some sort of a structure to provide either sea rescue or monitoring to avoid further border violence taking place. Among these people also, there are many individuals which they prefer not to be named that are organizing political grassroots movements within the areas that they operate, specifically for our case, Obisa Lesbos, that are also facing criminal charges, namely creating a smuggling network, espionage, and actually partaking in smuggling networks themselves. So the important note where we try to always underline here is this is the exact point where the establishment or states or supranational bodies such as EU is trying to dislink the communality of people on the move and people who are in solidarity with them are being criminalized in similar charges to dislink their potential common movements. And this is what we always try to target in a grassroots sense within Lesbos. And here is one of the specific assemblies that have been formed in Lesbos called Open Assembly Against Border Violence Lesbos. It's open to anybody who wishes to join. They're conducting their meetings every Wednesday in the social center of Binio, which is the only social center in the island, unfortunately. They are proposing interventions, demos, creating political inquiry texts, such as the one that you can see on the right, and organizing public events in order to draw attention, incredible data when it comes to pushbacks and border violence. Most of their pamphlets are available online, so if you wish to check them, go ahead. And for those of you who are interested, I can also send directly in mail. Most of us in Legal Center Lesbos are also members, like active members of this assembly. And the main thing that the assembly is trying to create as a horizon is that A, to create visibility about border violence, which is very invisible when you think about the containment policies that have actually succeeded in EU. And at the same time, to create a horizon about how people on the move, locals and international solidarity can work together, because this is what constitutes the whole assembly. We have migrants who are living on the island for some time. We have people on the move who have actually settled in the island for some time. Also asylum seekers themselves, along with people from international origin coming from different countries and locals from Lesbos specifically. So it is one of those rare events where people try to act all together with its all difficulties that Lucky also mentioned very beautifully, or unfortunately rather. And again, like to create, the important part is to somehow create a vision, a horizon maybe. Amir and Razuli's case, fortunately, have ended up with their release, although that they have been charged. And it was a court that has taken place for 3 years of constant struggle. This is a banner. The picture was taken around 2 a.m. in the morning in front of the court, which the court had taken place until that far on the day of their release. So in this vision, one thing that, at least in Lesbos, that we try to identify both NGOs, both more grassroots assemblies that are organized in social centers, is to identify, first of all, to understand that migration is not necessarily a consequence, but a structural matter. Ecological devastation, poverty, exploitation, population increase, and war do play an important role in its existence. And at the same time, to identify the cyclic relationship between displacement and border violence. We try to identify the link of who is profiting from the displacement in the first place of people, and the border violence that has been committed upon them when they're seeking safety or protection. We have been identified certain companies or bodies that are actually playing a key role in displacement in the first place, and also conducting, say, pushbacks to avoid people reaching to safety. So we also try to target this concept, not to focus on migration as a consequence, but as a vicious cycle of violence that have been cascading and reproducing itself again and again. So it's important to for sure to target global players when it comes to this, such as EU or NATO or coast guards of specific countries, but at the same time to organize locally and on an autonomous basis to without disregarding the political agency of people on the move. What we often also have trouble with over the course of years is this constant sense of treating people on the move as objects that are desiring help or support, which we try to alleviate and reject altogether and to understand the political own agency of people who arrive here with all the troubles that they've gone through or in the first place being persecuted due to their political beliefs or perspectives. Again, without being too long, I always like to remind this quote to myself, and we often go through it with my comrades as well, of this quote of Arendt, who herself was a migrant for a long time, is that if we are saved, we feel humiliated, and if we are helped, we feel degraded. So when we speak about the political agency of people on the move, at least within the context of this island, we try to avoid this humiliation or this degradation towards migrants themselves and try to identify the commons between the struggles of people on the move and people who are in solidarity with them. To maybe switch concepts such as, I don't know, privilege with concepts such as exploitation, to understand the structure that we currently sit upon is built on the foundation of exploitation, racism, and patriarchy. Therefore, to challenge this this connotation of this foundation through anti-racism, through anti-patriarchy, and through anti-exploitation, to link the movements and the political struggles of people on the move with these already existing movements that we have built upon somehow. Therefore, I would be very happy to kind of hear also maybe from you guys and maybe even a bit more from the movement of Masi, which is incredibly astonishing given the stuff that I read about them. And I leave the floor to the rest of the guys. I hope I didn't take too much time. And again, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Ozan. Thank you. That was very, very interesting. We'll just move straight on to the next speaker, whichever of you. I think you have a plan among yourselves as to who's going next, so I'll just leave it to you.
Yeah, I think I am next on the list. So thank you, everyone, and hello. Before I begin, I don't have a presentation, unfortunately, so I'm just going to be speaking, and hopefully you can follow what I'm saying. Yeah, I just wanted to say thank you to very much to the organizers of this event for inviting BVMN to be a part of this discussion. It is a pleasure to be here and to collaborate on and contribute to this much needed conversation, especially given the events of the past few months in Ireland. I'm Annie, and I've been working with BVMN since October of last year, and I'll be speaking on behalf of the network today. I guess I'm going to give you an insight, or hope to give you an insight, into who we are and what we do, and then hopefully also explain a little bit about what is happening here on the ground in Greece, where I'm currently based, because I think as many of you may already know, the latter will help provide a well-rounded view of why grassroots groups and movements like you and BVMN are so critical right now. So the Border Violence Monitoring Network is an independent coalition of NGOs and associations, mainly based in the Balkan regions and Greece. I think there's 10 organizations plus two anonymous ones. And it monitors human rights violations at the external borders of the European Union, and then advocates to stop the violence exerted against people on the move. It was first founded in 2016 when the so-called migration corridor was shut down, and several NGOs and grassroots collectives on the ground became aware and began to document what was happening, which was the violent illegal expulsion of people that were entitled to claim asylum under international law. So over time, the network has developed a common framework for the recording of testimonies, which after going through a thorough process of fact checking and verification, they're then uploaded onto our open access database that is available to anyone on the website. It's borderviolence.eu if anyone wants to have a look afterwards. We have a lot of reports and testimonies and a lot of information if people want to expand their knowledge a little bit. These case reports often include hard facts, visceral detailed accounts of the violations that have occurred, and sometimes as well pictures of the injuries sustained during the pushbacks. I would also mention here briefly that in the past couple of years, due to necessity, BVMN has begun to focus on cases of internal violence. So these would be incidences committed away from the border zones of member states and third countries, occurring more inland in cities, villages, towns, and rural areas. Examples of this would include targeted police operations and apprehensions of people on the move that then often result in pushbacks, illegal evictions of squats and accommodation facilities that many people grew to call home. In particular, BVMN has learned of the standardized arbitrary detention of people on the move that has become a characteristic of the anti-immigration position taken by member states. I will speak a little bit more in detail about this in a moment when I describe the current climate here in Greece. So why do we spend all this time monitoring and observing and watching what is taking place at and within European borders? Essentially, we aim to closely track these violations with the aim of recording and documenting these systemic practices so that in turn, it can be used to advocate for social and political change, both at international and national levels. So that is what we do. And then I would speak a little bit about our internal structure and the kind of objectives and responsibilities of each of the members and the groups. So to briefly summarize, the structure of BVMN, the network is divided into working groups. So we have the field teams, a research and investigation group, and then an advocacy group, which is then further split into legal, EU and UN branches. The field teams collect testimonies and visual data for the research and advocacy teams to analyze, verify, and then channel into relevant mechanisms. In addition, field teams are constantly in contact with people on the move, ensuring and trying to document the reality of the practices accurately and represent them and share them. So the legal working group, which I am a part of, can provide legal support to member organizations and individuals, and using knowledge that we collected by field reporters working on the ground, it provides input on pushback related cases brought to the European Court of Human Rights. And we also propose recommendations for legislative reform to EU lawmakers. I know this is like quite technical, but bear with me. The UN advocacy group then aims to get pushbacks and related violations recognized as key human rights issues at an international level. They do this through lobbying, written submissions, speaking at UN events, and collaborating with partners to influence the priorities of various human rights mechanisms. So to give an example, this month, a BVMN member attended a confidential briefing with the UN's Committee on the Rights of the Child to discuss evidence of pushbacks and attributed violations occurring in Bulgaria. So our partner organization, JOSUR, that had been previously active in Turkey, they had gathered an estimated, I think, 89 pushback testimonies from Bulgaria, which were presented to the committee and utilized to push for state accountability. So this is one of the many ways in which the UN group strives to promote recognition of pushbacks internationally. And then thirdly, the EU advocacy team, they focus largely on advocating for policy reform within EU institutions. It regularly publishes reports and briefings that analyse how the current security-centred EU approach to migration and access to asylum is directly harming people on the move and hindering their rights and preventing them from exercising their rights. On more than one occasion, members of the network have spoken on pushbacks at the European Parliament, most notably with the publication of the Black Book of Pushbacks, one of BBMN's most regarded publications. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's a 3 volumes, a printed collection of all the testimonies gathered by the members of the network since 2017. I actually have brought some of the copies. I only have 2, but you can see them here. They are like strikingly large and incredibly heavy. I don't know if you can see here, like, and they contain like hundreds, over 1,000 detailed accounts of pushbacks that contain severe violence and torture tactics and dehumanizing methods of humiliation and degradation inflicted by state actors against human beings. Yeah, it's really shocking, I think, when you see it like that. It's impossible to deny. So the testimonies collected are also widely used by journalists and researchers and academics and other bodies, anyone who wants to access them, to advocate for the rights of people on the move to be upheld, respected and valued the way they should be under what are often referred to as EU ideals and principles. So that's what we do. That's who we are. That is how we are structured. And then, like I said before, if I still have some time, I would just like to speak a little bit about what's happening here in Greece and what we've documented here, because that's where I'm based, so it's what I know. Greece, like a country that has been pivotal in any and all action plans taken to manage migration within the EU, being here, it's impossible to deny that the current way in which people fleeing war and persecution and oppression are being dealt with is incredibly dangerous and brutal, and also violates international, European and national laws. We've met with hundreds of men and women and children that have been callously pushed back from Greek territory and have had their pleas for asylum blatantly ignored by state officials. Many, many of these stories speak of severe physical and verbal abuse, sexual harassment and assault, racial attacks, theft of belongings, including phones, money, which I just want to say that transit groups are often really extremely dependent on, and also like invaluable personal possessions are stolen, so like jewelry and family heirlooms that like can never be replaced. People are often subjected to humiliating strip searches and a multitude of other cruel tactics perpetuated by masked men in uniforms most of the time. These experiences significantly contribute to the sufferings that displaced groups already endure and are likely to result in serious mental and physical health issues. As well as this, we have also heard countless reports from people that have been arbitrarily held for months and even sometimes years in both police stations and pre-removal detention centres. There's, I think, 7 of them across Greece, many of whom were denied their right to request asylum or to appeal their asylum decision. Additionally, again, in complete contravention to international human rights laws and standards, we have learnt of people being detained in informal detention sites described as old military bases or abandoned buildings. These periods of detainment almost always include the meager provision of substandard food and drinking water, inadequate hygiene facilities, overcrowded cells infested with rodents and cockroaches, denial of much needed medical and legal services, regular infliction of beatings and abuse, as well as prolonged periods of isolation used as a punitive measure. And when I say punitive measure, it's usually to respond to people who are asking or inquiring about their status of their asylum case, or if they're resisting against like the apparent treatment that they're facing. So it's not, you know, it's very basic things that they're asking for. Yeah, to be honest, this is only the tip of the iceberg and barely conveys the reality of what people on the move face every day in Greece and in Greek detention facilities. And this is the reality that Fortress Europe is creating, and what we are fighting against here. Unfortunately, in Greece, the powerful manipulation of the media, as Ozan touched upon earlier, like Greece currently falls 107th out of 180 countries in the Press Freedom Index. It's making this resistance very, very challenging. So along with restrictive laws for civil society actors and the use of surveillance, as well as significant lack of accountability by the Greek state and European actors, it's creating an extremely difficult landscape to operate in, and criminalization of human rights defenders, people on the move, and solidarity workers is a very, very real risk that people face every day when operating in this field. However, through the collective efforts of grassroots organizations and associations that came together to stand in solidarity and to resist the restrictive militarized border regime of the EU, BVMN continues to document and report and advocate with people on the move, and strives to facilitate a platform for their experiences to be shared and recognized by those who are responsible for the continued violence and unjustifiable disregard for human life happening every day. I think our work is just extremely important at the moment, given especially again in the context of Ireland, with the events of the past few months, and we should ensure that this is all being accounted for, so that we can try get some accountability and responsibility for people. With that, I would hand it over to Ezgi, if that's cool.
Okay. They have questions, of course, for you. I can't wait.
No, go ahead, ask it. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll take you next. Yeah.
To be honest, yesterday I had a bit stressed day, so I will try to do my best. But if it's not very clear, please feel free to ask me anytime. First of all, I'm involved in an activist group called We Want to Live Together initiative. This initiative is going back to 2019. And what we are doing mostly is like reporting cases of abuses on the Syrian border, mostly with other human rights associations and lawyer associations. And at the same time, we are organizing some events on the subject of migration and racism. And to be honest, grassroots in Turkey is not a very strong area. We are one of the only groups that is doing that. And already we are getting a lot of backlash. And we are mostly trying to organize the left-leaned groups. In that sense, mostly it is consists from Turkish people, but we have some Syrian comrades as well. The reason for that is they are mostly afraid to engage in such political affiliated organizations, but they are working in NGOs at the same time. What else we did recently? For instance, we organized a protest for, I don't know if you heard about it, a 19-year-old girl died recently in Karabük. She was from Gabon. And another one, a 9-year-old kid was murdered and raped in east of Turkey. So we, in coordination with feminist groups, we organized a protest for it. And we are still following the case of Dina, because we are thinking this case is not just individual case, and even a lot of bureaucrats in the city are involved, and they are trying to close the case. Other than that, at the same time, I'm working for an NGO, international NGO called Relief International, but here, actually, I'm not on behalf of them. That job is like more like my professional job. In that one, we are providing emergency operations in Northwest Syria, in Idlib area, mostly Idlib and Halep. There are hospitals, and we are providing support to the hospitals. And we have protection centers as well for women. In brief, this is what I do. When it comes to do other grassroots mechanisms in Turkey, there are a few more we know, such as Tarlabaşı. It's a neighborhood organization, and dating very back, as far as I know, and it includes people from very different backgrounds. And there is a new art space for Syrians as well. But I have to say, even though those exist, there is no coordination between all those groups. So this is what is lacking, because who are advocating for migrant rights in general getting a lot of backlash anyways. For instance, yesterday we tweeted a critic on the account of Kılıçdaroğlu, because he changed his election strategy and started to build it on migrants right now, basically by cooperating a very alt-right party. So afterwards, they were saying like there is 10 million Syrian in Turkey right now, which is not the correct date. Actually, there is, according to official statistics, 2.5 Syrians and 500,000 other nationalities are residing in Turkey. But their theory was not like that. And they are saying, if it is like this now, in a few years, they will be 30 million. And some people are picturing them as mostly like criminals, rapists, jihadists, you know, such a narrative. At the same time, when we look at Erdogan's side, he act like he migrants are his Muslim brothers, but at the same time, we followed a lot of torture cases on the border this year, which Human Rights Watch even published, but they were all denied. And a lot of children are being kept in EU-funded removal centers for many months. This is the general atmosphere. And with the election, as you see, it's very stressful, but hopefully we will find a way. If I try to explain the legal statuses in Turkey, Syrians are considered under temporary protection, which is different from refugee protection, because even though Turkey signed the convention, they put a geographical limitation, so we are just accepting refugees from Europe. This new created status, temporary protection, was given to only Syrians. It is similar to the refugee status, but at the same time, it can be canceled one-sided. And it gives very limited work permit. It's very hard to get work permit with this ID. So more educated, I could say, Syrians do not prefer to apply it, and they prefer to apply normal residency in Turkey because it's easier to get a work permit. And this is also the other reason why a lot of Syrians are working illegally currently. When it comes to Afghans and others, other nationalities, actually, it's even more harder for them. Accessing international protection is almost impossible. Like, it's like a matter of luck and very rare. We were following, for instance, this case, a minor Afghan child recently. He's still being kept in the removal center for many months, and he still couldn't get any status. But at the same time, he wants to go to France because his family is in France. But he can't apply for family reunification because he didn't get protection here. So basically, states are forcing people smuggling because there is no other way, basically. This is a very unfair system. And most of the kids we saw, actually, they don't even get chance for applying the process as well. They are just directly getting deported. And since in the society they are being as criminals and so on, not many people are backing them as well. And EU-Turkey deal is a big discussion point in that sense. They are saying, we don't want to make Turkey a refugee camp. And which, to be fair, EU-Turkey deal wasn't successful. I mean, for migrant sites as well, I don't think they get any benefit from this. The relocation process was mostly controlled by Migration Directorate. And it was, again, very limited. People could reach and could go through this road and relocate it. What else I can say? Other than that, the situation of Syrians and other nations here, it depends on their socioeconomic status as well, of course. We have some Syrians who have citizenship, for instance, because the government bring out a new law, which is called exceptional citizenship, because if you are under temporary protection, you can't get citizenship, no matter what you stay in Turkey. So they give 200,000 people to citizenship, and it should be mostly based on their education level and economical status, but sometimes we can see that it's arbitrary as well. And after the election, it's not clear also what will happen to them. What else? Again, Syrians who are under temporary protection, I hope I'm not confusing you so much. If it, I am, please let me know, because it's a very confusing subject, actually, in general. So some of them actually had temporary protection, but the same law applies that if you travel to another city, you need to get permission. And the cities that you can find job is limited as well. So they are moving to those cities and they are losing their temporary protection ID. So basically they are becoming without paper as well. This is occurring a lot at the same time. Also after 2018, we know that it was very hard to get temporary protection ID. So we have a lot of paperless people as well. So we are assuming either government will try to send them under so-called voluntary return to north of Syria because they don't have papers. And already in removal centers, it's a practice that has been done. Like they put you pressure to sign it. I think this is their plan. On the other hand, I think the opposition, if they come to power, they would like to make a deal with the regime. But at the same time, this creates another issue because we know that some people who went back to Damascus and they couldn't come back because they basically disappeared. So it's complicated. And when we try to defend the rights of these people, we are actually getting attacked as well. As we are getting funds from European Union to keep the refugees in Turkey, such words coming from them. What else I can mention? I mean, currently, again, the situation of the migrants is not great here, even though it's depending on the socioeconomic situation, especially poor families. They are struggling a lot. And many kids, they can't access education. And even if they do, I think they are getting bullied. Forced sex work is very common. Child labor is very common. Early marriage, again, very common. And now with the economic crisis getting deeper and deeper, they are the one to blame. I think. In brief, this is what I can say about the situation in Turkey. Of course, it's more complicated than that because there is a lot of groups and they are every one of them experiencing things differently in a sense. Especially with Syrians and other groups, there is distinctions because they are under temporary protection and some of them already get citizenship.
We leave it at that, yeah. Thank you, ASG. Yeah, thank you very much. I'd just like to say thanks to all of the speakers. I think you've given us a very broad overview of the huge obstacles that are faced by migrants, fleeing war, fleeing oppression, and trying to make it to Europe. And I'd just like to throw it open to the floor now in terms of questions or comments. I know it might be difficult for people on Zoom to hear comments from down the floor, but we'll do our best to try and get a bit of a conversation going. I suppose just in relation to the information that we've been given, where things are at for ourselves in Ireland at the moment, what we can do or what we should be trying to do, and maybe even a conversation with Lucky about the supports or ways in which Massey needs support from us and the ways in which he mentioned at the end of his conversation the growth of the far right stuff over recent months. If people have any comments or questions, either specific questions or comments you'd like to make, please feel free. Go ahead, yeah.
This might sound kind of awful and immoral, but how can people support these efforts if they don't have much money to spare? How can people support it if they don't have much money to spare? I know it sounds evil, but not everybody has much that they can give in terms of money.
Yeah. And I suppose it's what I would say is it's not necessarily about giving money, but it's about looking at what we can do in terms of our time, in terms of our effort, in terms of our solidarity. Yeah. From that perspective, probably. Maybe Lucky, you'd like to.
Yeah. Support cannot be attributed to money. Skills people can bring on the table. Time, compassion, seeing the people in, like, in our context, for instance, we've got people that are staying on outside the tents, showing up there and give support without anything. People need to have that touch to share that love, you know, with a new person. If a person that is new and is stuck on the streets, and there's somebody that is friendly to talk to, it gives a lot, you leave a lot on that person.
Yeah.
So that's it. Don't look into money.
Okay, so you can just help by volunteering time, maybe going over there and being
friendly. Share, I mean, things are happening online.
Mm-hmm.
Post about positive things online. Address the negative things that are happening online. Those are the things that people can do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucky. Anybody else?
May I make a very short comment also?
Yes, please do.
I mean, I think this is a very legit point when you also feel at a point either you're economically not in that position, nor at a point that you want to do something, but you're unable to. Well, I couldn't agree more with Lucky. And maybe to take it one step forward is also like to educate yourself. It's very important. And I think like reaching out to people who are on the move or actually trying to understand what the organizations or political movements that are on the field working on this matter in solidarity, to see what they have achieved and what they have failed is also incredibly important in terms of understanding what you can and can't do. Because I think one part of this whole journey is it's inevitable, the fact that migration is older than the history of humanity itself, in a way. So it will always be a part of our life. And to identify where it links with our own lives and with our own futures and political struggles that we are more accustomed to carry on, such as feminism, gender movement, ecology, and so on and so forth, where they link with this matter, to identify those is also very much about like self-education. And from a very personal point of view, please, I hope I'm not sounding patronizing in any way. That's not my intention. But like self-education, really, it's incredibly valuable. And touching people, is there is no better way to understand in order to realize what you can do and can't do. I think there is not just one simple answer, go on and do that. But definitely from where Lucky started in terms of touching other people's lives is a great, great point to start and to read and follow a little bit about what's happening by other movements. It's incredibly fruitful to understand what you can and can't do. And believe me, you will find millions of other options that is not coinciding with money.
Okay.
And maybe I could add to that as well, that I think a lot of the conversations we have in our workplaces, in our communities, anytime that we hear myths or racist comments or whatever, to challenge them and to really work on that in terms of, it does, again, it's not something that takes money. It takes a bit of courage sometimes to do that, to be the one that would challenge a racist comment or challenge when, you know, the far right tropes are being trotted out by people. Challenging that and in our day-to-day lives, I think is very, very important. That way we can offer a lot of solidarity. Anybody else feel they'd like to make a comment or have a question? I think we're maybe all a bit overwhelmed by the amount of information we've got. Yeah, go ahead, yeah.
I want to have a question for you, Lucky. You talk about people, that some people were afraid to raise concerns and complain. And but what is the border? What are the limits that people can protest? And does Irish government retaliate against those people? I know you said that you've received a residency. What about other people?
Well, there isn't any retaliation per se when a person has vocalized their concerns. We encourage people to follow the grievance procedure that the international protection applicants have been, who are in direct provision, have to do. And it's important for us to educate them that there is a way to address these things without the fear, of which they are allowed to address things with the local management if the issue is with regard to where they stay, all right? So, and if they are not satisfied with that, and there's always pushbacks from the local management when people start, that's why they say, you know, you are lucky to even have a bed here, you know? So, but it's us is to just make sure that people do understand that they have a right to do that. And if they are not satisfied, they go to the IPAS, the International mm-hmm. Protection Applicant Services that deals with accommodation. And also there's an Office of the Ombudsman for direct provision that specifically addresses those complaints. And if the sender or the people in the sender decide to take an action, they can take that action without any kind of pushback from the government. Obviously, the intimidation will always be there, calling the guards to intimidate people. You know, that is the modus operandi with these guys, to just call the guards. But if you know what you are doing, you have strategized, you're brave enough to stand up to those guards that these are the issues that you are facing. There's no criminal offense that has been perpetrated here. So yeah, and that does not stop the process of people getting their status in the state. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Loki.
Alan, yeah.
Could I jump in there? I just wanted to say, adding on to what Loki had said earlier about things we could do, that like obviously it's really hard to know what to do in the face of the rights of the far right and everything's so terrible. But something we've been doing for years with Massey, I'm part of a group called Ramsey, Refugee and Migrant Solidarity Ireland, and maybe some people know already about the solidarity dinners we do, that we've been organizing for, I think, since 2016. So with Massey and sometimes with like Cat 2 and Cooking for Freedom, which is just like a big community dinner we've had over a few years, every few months, that used to be in Jigsaw, which Jigsaw's now gone, so we've done it in Bose the last few times. But it's bringing people together in our provision centres and local people and having food and having talks for Massey and sometimes other groups about organising and things that are going on. And it's something very small, but like it's bringing people together to form community and like hope, and through that different things have come out of it over the years, like the group Cooking for Freedom, who are a group of asylum seekers who organise to get kitchens so they can cook, because in lots of centres they weren't able to cook. And like things like laptop drives, organizing laptop drives to get laptops to people in their provision during the lockdowns, and just things like that that are not going to change the system, but are small practical ways of being in solidarity with people. So our last dinner was a few weeks ago, I can't remember.
Yeah, 30th April.
And
yeah.
It's been hard to get them up running again after COVID. We used to do them like every months, then every 2 months, and then COVID happened. So we've only had three, I think, since COVID, or four. I think that was our fourth one again.
Yeah.
So we're trying to get them rolling again, which, you know, it takes energy and commitment to like organize this group, get them going. But that's something a few people in Dublin are doing at the moment. So people, you know, are interested, you can follow online, and we'll be putting up stuff with Massey for the next one, hopefully not too far away. And also I was going to say, like, if you're living somewhere else in Ireland, obviously there's people being moved all over the place, and local people in some places responding so horrifically. And I think just like Loki's saying, like going to the centres, trying to meet people, having tea with them, bring food, you know, like things like that can definitely go a long way, I think. So yeah, I just wanted to say there are a few things going on that people could like look into.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Anybody else?
Okay.
if you look, it's my body language.
Oh, sorry.
it's a very emotional topic to me, I imagine for a lot of people. So I'm going to start with just saying how I feel. I feel like the targeting of refugees in Ireland has reached another level this week. For me, headcounts and segregating refugees into, you know, the refugees who are better and are worthy to stay in Ireland and the ones who, you know, are claimed unvetted or illegitimate or whatever, that's, as someone who studied the Holocaust, it's really, really scary and worrying. And Lucky, I think I could relate to what you were saying, kind of describing the situation. Just kind of, I guess, a comment from something that is very apparent from the talks. And thank you to all the speakers for really insightful kind of presentations. Is that there is this kind of segregation happening in all locations of refugees into the kind of, you know, in Turkey, it could be the Syrians who are, you know, due to their socioeconomic background, you know, they are better refugees, and obviously that maybe enables them in terms of opportunities. So there's segregation happening everywhere in Poland. Poland accepts the Ukrainian refugees, but not refugees coming from Belarus, which are basically refugees from the Middle East, which are brown, colored, or black, and they die in forests. And people who bring them, you know, food or drink, they are being imprisoned or threatened by prison. So there's also the, I like there was a concept or kind of a phrase, which is the criminalization of solidarity that we see that is happening. And another thing is how the governments are acting. And I think this is something that is really interesting to think about Ireland and where Ireland is going in terms of, you know, responding to the sentiment within the society. So the growth of the far right, but it's obviously spilling into, you know, my colleague here, and we teach students, and the students are first year students, and you know, they might be having already some opinions, you know, about refugees and immigrants that are, you know, they just pick it from without having much knowledge about that. But it's interesting to see that there is the kind of official narrative, and then there's practices or actually a lack of action. I think we saw this in Ireland. I looked at Twitter a lot this week, and I felt a lot of people were like, you know, why nothing was done, you know, why these people were protesting or not. So that the, I think, in Turkey, you know, Erdogan saying, well, these are our Muslim brothers, but actually, you know, then we know that this horrific violence happening. So I actually have a question to, sorry, I forgot the name of the Turkish speaker, because there's two names.
Ezgi.
Yeah, I would be interested to actually know, and again, kind of thinking about Ireland and where we're gonna, how we're gonna move from here. You know, there's elections happening in Turkey at the moment, and I was wondering, was there any change of the narrative around like Syrian refugees before the election and during the election as a response to that kind of resentment, growing resentment from the Turkish population that you talked about? So you talked about like people being kind of, you know, unhappy and saying, oh, you know, how many more refugees can from Syria can we have? So I was wondering, was there any change of the story, of the narrative by the government in Turkey around the time of elections?
From government side, right?
Yeah.
I think his narrative changed. As I mentioned, now he's advocating for a voluntary return in the North Sea Syria area. This is his strategy as far as I can see. And he will not say that I will be sending them by force, but he will be sending them to the North Syria, which is not a safe place at all. and it's full of jihadists too at the same time. This is his strategy as far as I can see. But he would not say, I will send them by force. But at the same time, due to a lot of issues because of earthquake, maybe people lost their IDs or they will not get extensions. Such things can make them have no more ID. So they can find themselves going to North Syria with, if they want it or not. Because the situation here is also economically not getting better. So they could think like maybe the life there could be better, that sort of thing. This is what I understood for now.
Just to make, thank you for that. Just to make a few comments, yeah. Firstly, thanks, Alan, for bringing that with no access. Those dinners made us to bring people from these centers to meet with people and interact with people, and then everything then moves on from there onwards. And a lot of friendship has been born out of that. And it's very, very important that there is that link between, in terms of integration as well, that link between the people that that are placed in these centers and the general public that wants to meet with people and know people and do something with the people have got that opportunity when that event happens. And we always publicize
Did the connection drop for you guys too?
Yeah, for me, yes. I guess we wait a little bit and see what comes up. Whoop, we're alone.
And that's where my blood just boiled, speaking with that journalist. I've never heard of that. In Ireland, we've faced a lot of these things from the far right. But to that extent, I really, really have never seen that. And it brought me back to that kind of experience of why must we allow people to degrade people to that extent?
Yeah, thanks, Lucky. It's not necessarily a positive note on which to finish the meeting, but
let me just say,
sorry, I didn't realize we finished. Apologies.
Let me just say this. We are organizing from Mercy and which is extended to each and every person, each and every group. On the 20th of June is the International Refugee Day. And we have declared that we will have a rally or a demo somewhere in Dublin at 5:30 because it's a weekday, and we want everybody to be part of that, to celebrate the lives of refugees here and abroad for the sterling work that they bring in our shores. We need to pass that message of what refugees, migrants bring in this country and other countries. That day is an International Refugee Week. Let us make our voice loud and clear of welcoming refugees and celebrating the fact that I am a refugee. I'm no different to nobody. And I'm here and to make a change, to make a contribution, to make a difference. And I am here to stay. Whether some people don't like it or not, but I am gonna be here. With you.
I'd just like to say a huge thank you to all of the speakers. I think anyone that's here will agree it was a very, very informative meeting. One of the reasons for organizing this event is to bring people together to try and help us to educate ourselves more about the struggles that other people are facing, that we can become part of, the ways in which we can offer hands of solidarity and support to people in struggle. And I think given that this meeting certainly has fulfilled that criteria in terms of giving us a lot of information and stuff, I would please urge everybody, we are in quite a turning point at the moment in relation to where things are at, and the sort of campaigning that Massey are involved in, and the need for us to all be visibly challenging the narrative of the far right, challenging the narrative of the state, and that each one of us in every single way that we can do so, will do so. And I think if out of this meeting, we each give a pledge that we're going to do what we can in terms of that. And even if, even just in terms of trying to attend the event on the 20th of June and publicize it, but also the people at Mount Street and people who are currently in Inch, if anybody's in that part of the country, and other refugees, asylum seekers do need, as Lucky mentioned earlier on, just people, a friendly voice, people talking to them, saying hello to them, and that. So thanks very much for coming along to the meeting, and hopefully you all gained something from it, and hopefully we'll be able to take what we gained from it, and if we meet again in a year's time, maybe have a more positive conversation that we have turned things around a bit. All right, thanks very much, everyone. Thank you to our two speakers for taking time out of your busy schedule. Nice. Thanks all. The next meeting that's in this room at 2 o'clock is gender and anarchism, and at 2 o'clock, climate action panel is in the next room. Thanks all. Cheers.
Take good care of yourselves, guys. See you.
Bye bye.
Right, thank you.
I didn't see you.
No, give me. I didn't.
All right, I
love. Hold on, guys.
Yeah, what?
Hi, Liam.
No.
Okay, guys, enjoy the rest of your Saturday and your weekend.
Yes.
See you
later, honey. Yeah. Well done.
Nice
bye-bye.
To meet you. Bye bye.
Gonna see you. Bye. 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 Bye.